You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. Lieutenant Governor Jerry Abramson has been in his new post since January. He started right out of the gate with a plan to reform the state's taxing system. He's head of the Blue Ribbon Tax Commission, which had its first town hall meeting this week in Paducah. We spoke earlier this week after his keynote address at the Murray Callaway County Chamber of Commerce breakfast.
The first public meeting of the Tax Commission yielded some public comment. Can you summarize what you heard last night?
You know, we were in Paducah. As you said, we're holding public meetings in each of the congressional districts, and we started in the first district. So we were there last night in Paducah. I had about 100 people in the audience, had about 20 speakers, and I think most of them were focused on the issue of elasticity and adequacy. A lot of discussion by educators, a lot of discussion by mental health advocates based on the cuts or the lack of increases over the last decade, two decades, regarding the funding available for K through 12 education and mental health, community health networks. There were several folks who gave us ideas about changes of this kind of tax, or what Ohio might have done we ought to look at, or what Oklahoma has done we ought to look at. And we had our consultant with us, and he'll be at all the meetings to be able to do just that, to research some of the issues that some of the citizens brought to our attention and work toward the five areas that the governor has asked us to focus on. First and foremost is fairness, competitiveness with other states, simplicity in terms of compliance, the focus on elasticity, meaning when the economy gets better, there's additional funds that we can use for public university education, K through 12, community colleges, state police, all these areas that have been cut. And the final was adequacy. Those were the 5 points that the governor has asked us to focus on. Most of the discussion last night was on adequacy and elasticity, but there were some specific areas of tax code changes that several of the business folks asked us to look at.
Were there any comments about challenges that these individual business owners face that you were unaware of, things that caught you by surprise?
You know, I don't think there was anything that I was unaware of. I heard about a new program implemented in, I think it was Ohio. I wrote down the note and asked our research team to look into it to see it's been in effect for about a year and how it's doing. Someone got up and said it was the silver bullet, the answer to all answers. It was going to really, really turn the transformational in terms of Ohio. So we're going to look at that and see what it's about. But, you know, I mean, 70% of the tax revenues into the Commonwealth of Kentucky come from two areas, sales tax and income tax. As you know, in terms of sales tax, we don't have sales tax on groceries. Tennessee does. Tennessee's got 9.6% sales tax. I think it's the second highest in the country. On the other hand, they don't have an income tax. And so what does that mean, and how should we respond? And so we're looking at Illinois. Illinois just raised its tobacco tax, as an example. We were reminded last night by an advocate who felt that we should increase our 60 cents a pack, because Illinois just raised theirs a dollar more, bringing it, I think, to $1.95, if I'm not mistaken, is what the speaker said. So if they're at $1.95 and we're at 60 cents, the advocate said, raise it so that we'll make more money. And, oh, by the way, that will ultimately help in the sense of fewer young people starting to smoke, and therefore will save us money in the long run in terms of health care bills. So it's a balancing act in terms of approaching the future of tax reform, and that's what this group of 23 is going to have to do to create a response to the governor's charge.
But this isn't the first time the Commonwealth has looked into tax reform in general, and in the end, it's going to take buy-in from the General Assembly on both sides.
It is going to take buy-in, and that's why I think the governor was very smart in asking the leadership of the Senate to select two Republican senators for the commission, and the minority leader of the Senate to select a Democrat. And that's what we have. And on the House side, to have the leadership of the House select two Democratic reps and the minority leader to select one. And we have, as a result, the budget chairman, the finance and budget chairman of both the Senate and the House, are members of this committee. So the hope is they're not voting members, but ultimately they will have heard and listened and learned a great deal, as we all are, going through this process. And when the recommendations are made, we're hopeful that they will be a part of the advocacy to get the legislature to pass them.
We spoke to retiring lawmaker Mike Cherry from Princeton, 4th District State House Representative, and we talked about a bit of the stiff partisanship that we see in the House and the Senate. And he says individually, members of the State House and Senate are largely bipartisan people, but when they come together as a body, when they come together in their respective caucuses, is whenever you see that stiff partisanship. while you may have great buy-in from legislators now, do you get the sense that you'll still run into roadblocks when the House and Senate convene again next
year? Well, I'm sure there'll be people that will disagree with whatever the consensus decision recommendations are from this blue ribbon group. But, you know, you need a majority. And the hope is that we'll be able, with Republicans and Democratic legislators on the Blue Ribbon Commission, that they will help us with their respective caucuses to move the proposals forward. It's going to take a decision by the legislature. And so this isn't just done by a stroke of the pen of the governor. So we understand that. And we're not fighting windmills here. I mean, this is no Don Quixote joust. We want to be practical. We want to be realistic. I'd be surprised if the group proposed any off-the-wall, wild and crazy things. Having said that, we need to be fairer, more competitive with other states. We need to be more elastic in terms of our code. And we are getting over this recession. As that happens, we need to be postured and positioned to be able to generate the revenues that our K-12, early childhood, community colleges, universities, they've been cut and cut and cut. State police down to the lowest number on the street in a long time. Those kinds of issues need to be resolved and responded to. And as the economy gets better, we just want to be sure we're in the right position to provide the services that people in Kentucky want.
Do you think the work will be finished in November like planned?
Yeah, that's the game plan. We'll do it before Thanksgiving, and then the governor can decide whether to call a special session after the November election, or he could wait until January. But in that legislative session, it would take more than a majority to make these changes because it's the off session. Or, based on where the national economy is and whether we're coming out of the recession, if we're still deeply into a recession, that's not the time. And the governor said that time and again. If the economy is still very fragile, you really step back a little bit and assess, is this the time to make the changes? Or he could wait till the following year.
Do you have any other priorities as lieutenant governor?
Well, personally, I mean, I'm very actively involved right now in working with K-12 education, implementing a program, and we're going to do it in 5 pilot schools around the Commonwealth, where 25% or 30% only of the graduates go on to college. We're working on developing a program that I was successful in having in Louisville that moved that number from 30% going to college to 70% going to college. You're going to see me, and I continue to work with the community colleges to ensure that they're putting out the men and women that the businesses need with the skills necessary to keep those businesses productive. And I'm working in economic development. I was just in New York meeting with a group of consultants who represent companies looking to relocate. And so I'm working in the area, and I've had a lot of experience in the area, both small and large business attraction and assistance for them to grow and expand. And I guess the final would be working with cities and counties. You know, having been a mayor and a county judge gives me an opportunity to relate and to work for them up at the state level.
And during the campaign, Governor Beshear's challenger, the late Gatewood Galbraith, said off the cuff one night during a debate that Governor Beshear would seek a Senate seat halfway through his term as governor, leaving you to assume his position. Any truth to that?
Not one ounce of truth to that. In fact, when he said it, I was there, and I proceeded to get in the car, and as I was driving back from wherever we were toward home, I called Governor Beshear and I said, "Now, that's not true, is it?" He said, "No, that's not true." I said, "That wasn't our deal. We're supposed to spend these 4 years together." And so I expect to have 4 good, healthy years together with Governor Beshear. He will be our governor, and I will be his lieutenant governor.
Is it too early to say whether or not you'd like to run for governor in 4 years?
Yeah, I think it's way too early. I mean, way too early. I'm just learning and enjoying, and hopefully over time we'll see if I can help make a difference and add some value to my home state.
Lieutenant Governor Jerry Abramson, thanks for your time.
Great to be with you.
Murray's Playhouse in the Park continues their summer season with Doubt, a Parable. The play explores themes of suspicion, intuition, gossip, and their effect on a Catholic church in the 1960s Bronx. Father Brendan Flynn is suspected of inappropriate relations with an altar boy, and without proof that he did it, leaves the church after threats to his reputation. Rose Kristen Preston sat down with Stacy Smith, who plays the stern sister Aloysius, and director Don Fleming to talk about this culturally loaded play.
What prompted Playhouse to put on this play?
This was a play that I had really wanted to see us do, and it's a serious play, so a lot of people don't necessarily want to come see it. But it's a very good play. It was on Broadway a few years ago, and Cherry Jones, who's from Paris, Tennessee, actually was in it. It's a very powerful play, and so we wanted to include that in our season.
So what considerations did you guys take as far as being sensitive to any Catholics that might be in the crowd?
The premise of the play is based, you know, being in the Catholic Church, but the play really is more about confidence in yourself and in your beliefs. You know, the suspicion of doubt is a very powerful thing.
Do you have an opinion on whether or not Father Flynn did it?
Well, as Sister Aloysius, yes, I have to say he did it.
All right, Stacy.
As Stacy, I still think there's something shady going on there. There definitely is.
Did that affect your approach to Father Flynn's character?
Yeah, Daryl and I typically try to antagonize one another in rehearsal. I feel like there's some guilt there. And so I didn't have to stretch too far. And I certainly can identify with the feelings of believing so strongly in something and trying to do the right thing. And people may be mistaking you trying to do the right thing, but in your heart, you feel it's right. And that's what she's dealing with.
What do you want the audience to discuss on their car ride home after seeing this?
How certain are you of the decisions that you make in the future? And, you know, maybe perhaps reflect on some of the things that have happened in the past, as Stacy sort of touched on, and Sister James mentions in the play, some of the things that, as you were growing up, they've shaped you into the person you are today. And, you know, kind of discuss those sorts of things.
What was the most challenging part of this play for you?
I think for me was trying to keep my own opinions and biases out and just trying to stay neutral with it. There were so many times during the rehearsal process that I really wanted to do something that would really cast some serious doubt on the character, whether that's change in lighting or background music that's kind of, you know, sort of the subtle signs, but I didn't want to do too many things like that.
What about you, Stacy?
I guess the biggest challenge for me, or the biggest thing hanging over me, is the fact that Meryl Streep played this part in the movie, and I love her, and I think she is incredible. When I tell people that I'm in the play, and they say, "Oh, are you Meryl Streep?" and I think, please don't say it like that. So that I feel like those are really big shoes to fill, or at least to follow in. So trying to discard any memories I have of the movie and make this my own, where I identify with it in my way, that has been a big challenge for me.
Do you think that this play needs to be seen?
Absolutely. Yeah. There are very important issues, not, you know, not even referring to the scandal, but the things going on in the world today, that hatred and the misunderstanding, you know, this, as Stacy said, her character's approach to dealing with the students is very cold and strict, and, you know, this is the way they've done it for 1,000 years, so why change a good thing? And Father Flynn is more liberal in his approach. Sister James is very warm and caring. And so they're all three different approaches, and so that's an immediate clash right there. We have those things going on in the world right now, you know, in the Middle East or here in America with all the, you know, political garbage that I really don't even want to get into. But it's unfortunate that those things happen, but it's what these people believe and what these people believe, and trying to meet in the middle can be a very difficult thing.
Dowd runs this weekend and next at Murray's Playhouse in the Park. You can find a complete list of dates and showtimes at WKMS.org. There's a debate brewing in the U.S. horse industry over whether or not to adopt synthetic tracks. Experts say they're safer for horses and riders. Others want to stick with traditional racetracks that have been with the industry for generations. But with grandstands emptying out, critics say track owners are putting profits over safety in order to attract a new generation of race fans. From Public Broadcasting's Innovation Trail Project on Track Tech, Kentucky Public Radio's Matt Laszlo reports from Maryland.
When that bugle heralds the start of the Preakness here at Baltimore's Pimlico Racecourse, thousands of people wearing Sunday's best will be in these grandstands while college students party away in the infield. Not today. The infield is just track workers, and the grandstands are eerily desolate. The only people here today are the hardcore bettors and some family members they dragged along.
How are that 3-1-2? How are that 3-1-2?
Like every other stop of the Triple Crown, Pimlico has a dirt track. Critics say dirt is more harmful for horses than the new generation of synthetic racetracks. Former jockey and trainer Michael Dickinson was dubbed the genius of horse racing in his native Britain. He now manufactures Tapita tracks, a hodgepodge of wax, sand, recycled clothes, and, of course, some secret materials.
We want it pliable. We want it obedient. It's an obedient surface. Unlike my wife, my racetrack will do anything I ask it to do.
The Jockey Club reports nearly 50% fewer horse fatalities on synthetic surfaces than on their dirt counterparts. That's part of the reason Dickinson loves showing off his spongy version.
See how it bounces back? Yeah. It's got life to it. But he's got to have stability from the rear end, so when he pushes it off, he doesn't want to be spinning his wheels.
With so many horses avoiding catastrophic injuries, Dickinson's business is expanding in the UK, Australia, and the United Arab Emirates. It's even the surface for the Dubai World Cup, but those customers are overseas. Dickinson doesn't manufacture his product in the States anymore. There's just no market.
The only reason not to put a synthetic in is a cost. They're about $4 million. Okay, so it's a big ticket item.
It's not all dollars and cents. Another reason synthetics haven't caught on in the U.S. is cultural. Trainer Larry Murray's horses have raced in the Preakness, and he's not sold on synthetics.
It's different. It's different for the horses. They have different injuries because of it. And I don't really think it's any safer. I think a well-maintained dirt track is just as good. But I think that's the key, is a well-maintained dirt track.
It's true. Veterinarian Kathleen Anderson says on dirt tracks, you typically get more chipped and broken bones. While on synthetics, there are harder to diagnose hind leg injuries. Anderson treats horses at the Fairhill Training Center in Northern Maryland, which boasts a dirt track alongside its synthetic. Comparing injuries from the two tracks, Anderson chooses synthetics.
Just like artificial turf with football players, they probably have more stress-related injuries than necessarily concussion-related injuries, and similar with horses.
In the U.S., California took the lead on synthetics. The state's racing commission mandates them. The results are mixed. Santa Anita Park laid a multi-million dollar synthetic course, but has won permission for a return to dirt. Mike Wellman, who directs publicity at the park, says their synthetic surface proved troublesome.
It became readily apparent very early on that we had some very serious drainage problems, and we had a number of cancellations over a two-year period.
The technology is improving rapidly, but the skepticism has hardened, and extra cash just isn't there. Graham Motion trained the winner of last year's Kentucky Derby, Animal Kingdom. He's a fan of synthetics, but says the erratic rollout in California and elsewhere sets the technology back indefinitely.
I'm afraid that we might have already missed the boat with the synthetics. I'm afraid the way they were introduced to racing in this country, I think people are so down on them, I'm not sure that they're going to be around very long.
That's a dire prediction for a technology that's reported to save horses' lives. But for an industry that itself is on wobbly legs, there just doesn't seem to be much appetite for pricey innovations in America's horse racing industry. For Kentucky Public Radio in Maryland, I'm Matt Laszlo.
Track Tech is a collaboration between WEKU Radio, Louisville Public Media, and Public Broadcasting's Innovation Trail. Work will soon start to rebuild Missouri's Birds Point Levee along the Mississippi. It was blown up in 2011 to save communities downriver from historic flooding. And we'll look at the levee's impact when we come back. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. Three companies, including one from Kentucky, have landed contracts totaling up to $20 million to repair the Birds Point Levee in Missouri. The Mississippi River Levee was blown up last year to avert the flooding of Caro, Illinois, in Fulton County, Kentucky. The Army Corps of Engineers is overseeing the project, which will restore the levee to its former strength. Drew Adams speaks with Corps Project Director Dennis Abernathy about the impact of the levee on Kentucky residents.
Harold Coffey of Hickman County and his company was one of the three that were awarded contracts to repair the Birds Point levee. What type of work will they be doing?
That contract, we awarded it to three different contractors, but only one contractor at this time has actually been giving a task order to do work. That was to the Youngs General Contracting from Poplar Bluff, Missouri. As we go forward, we'll have more task order works that will come out, and each of the three firms that was awarded that contract will be allowed to compete for those individual task orders on a cost basis. All of the task orders are geared to levee rebuilding, the levee back to what it was before we activated it. The latter task orders will also include installation of the piping work that we would need when or if we have to reactivate the floodway sometime in the future.
And what is this first task order that the other company won? What will that be covering?
That will be at the upper crevasse. We're rebuilding it back to an elevation equivalent to 55 feet. There's three different crevasses, and we're going to build each one of them up to 55 feet in full width. If we have satisfactory progress with that work, and if we are able to update our operation plan as to how we would install the operating mechanisms, and if we can make sure there's no unacceptable risk in other parts of the area, then we would issue task orders to complete the work back to 62.5.
Assuming everything goes to plan, how long do you think it will take before the levee is built back up?
If we are able to work out all those other issues and meet those conditions, our goal is to have it by December of this year.
That is quite a tall order, isn't it?
It's a very aggressive schedule, and it's going to require good contractor performance, and we're going to have favorable weather also.
And is that in anticipation of possible rain for next year in 2013?
No, it's just we want to get that protection back as soon as possible. Currently, you know, we're at some of our historical lows, which has been very good for us this year.
Who's funding the work?
Corps funding this. Now, there was a supplemental bill on the emergency flooding and appropriations bill that they passed this year. So it's all federally financed.
What impact, if any, will be on the Kentucky residents upstream of the levee?
It would be no different than what it was prior to operation. I mean, we're putting back the same system that was there in advance. So, I mean, their systems are designed for this floodway to be in place. So, it would not be an impact.
Do you think once we're done with this, will Fulton residents be safer than they were previously with the Bridge Point levee?
We got a project over there that's been historically, we've had under seepage problems in that area. The contract that we'll be awarding this year will install 111 relief wells in that area. It will greatly improve the ability of that levee system to pass a major flood without having these sand bore problems that we always have. So it's going to provide greater protection not only to Western Kentucky, but also into West Tennessee, because that levee system in Kentucky does provide protection all the way down into Tennessee.
Can you describe to me in layman's terms what the relief wells do?
They allow the water to come out or exit from underneath the levee in a controlled manner so that you don't remove the sands that are beneath the levee. When the water tries to come underneath, it tend to try to bring the sandy material with it and the finer grain material with it. Well, these relief wells capture the water, but where they have a filter screen design in them, it lets the water come out, but it traps the fine grain material and keeps it in the ground.
This levee is being built in such a way that if something of the caliber of 2011 or larger came, you would have to blow it again?
Yes, okay. That's why we're not going above 55 until we are sure that we can put in a mechanism to do that.
Are there sluice gates? Are there any other way that you could put something in that you wouldn't have to blow the levee, or is that just the best and easiest way?
That's the approved plan that we have now. We are not funded to put in gates or anything like that. They'd probably be very cost prohibitive. That has been looked at in the past and was found not to be economically viable. That would be something that probably certainly in the future that may be looked at. But right now, the only alternative is to do what we have approved now and use a blasting agent.
Drew Adams spoke with Army Corps of Engineers Project Director Dennis Abernathy.
Going to the movies is one of those experiences that everyone should be able to enjoy. You settle into your seat with some popcorn, maybe a little candy, and when the lights dim, you're in another world. But for some with disabilities, like autism, going to the movies can be almost impossible. Now, however, movie theaters all over the country are taking steps to change that. Here in Murray, the Cherie Theaters have started playing movies that are sensory-friendly for children. Gary Pitts looks into what that entails and what it means for families with children who have disabilities.
Movies today are better than ever, at least as far as picture and sound quality are concerned. The days of the old 35mm reel are gone, replaced by Dolby high-definition digital projectors. And the sound is just as crisp and clear as the picture, with Dolby digital surround sound creating an aural landscape. But for some, all of these advances have done nothing more than push them away from the theater. People who have autism and other disabilities are often extremely sensitive to light and sound, so the more intense it is, the more unbearable it becomes for them. This is especially so for children.
There's many families here that either have not ever been to a movie since their child was born, or have been to one and never come back.
Heather Price was the president of the National Student Speech, Language, and Hearing Association chapter at Murray State University.
She says her group presented the idea of sensory-friendly movies to Murray Sharif Theater in April for Autism Awareness Month.
It's a big deal for families to actually get to have that simple life pleasure of coming to a movie theater because they don't get that anymore.
So what does the theater do to make the movie experience more enjoyable for children with sensory sensitivities? Chris Hopkins is the general manager at Sharif Theaters.
We leave the house lights up so that the room doesn't get dark. We lower the volume. A lot of kids are sensitive to sound. We don't put any previews on because when they come to see a movie, they want to see that movie and nothing else.
And many of the standard movie-going rules don't apply during these showings, including the golden rule.
We don't mind if they talk. We don't mind if they get up and move around.
But the movie experience isn't limited to just the show itself. The standard fare of popcorn, candy, and a Coke, as delicious as it may be, doesn't always fit the bill for those who have restrictive diets. Children with autism often have food allergies, so on sensory-friendly days, they can bring their own snacks as well. Hopkins says at the first showing in April, there were around 60 people who showed up. Among them was Marilyn York.
People who actually have autism that can talk to you will tell you that sometimes something sounds probably 100 times louder than what the normal person might hear it.
York's son, who's 14 years old, was diagnosed with autism when he was 4. She says he's sensitive to light and sound, and he does have a restrictive diet. So the sensory-friendly showing allows her to bring him to the movies when she otherwise wouldn't be able to do so. And that's a big deal.
It helps them learn how to act in social settings and how to be appropriate behavior around others and just gets them out.
When York and her son came to the showing in April, she says it was one of the few times he was able to sit through an entire movie. So with changes made and restrictions lifted, children with disabilities and their families are free to go to the movies. The theater had its second sensory-friendly showing this past week, Pirates Band of Misfits. The atmosphere was relaxed. Everyone's sitting back, momentarily free of worry, just enjoying the show. For WKMS News, I'm Gary Pitts.
Internet service problems have plagued our region for just over a week now, and as inconvenient as it is for most of us, imagine heading up one of our area's libraries, just as the Commonwealth's new e-book lending program, Kentucky Unbound, rolls out. That very thing is the signal challenge for Callaway County Public Library's new director, Manon Pittman, but more than two decades with the library means Pittman is more than up to that challenge. I traveled to the library to speak with Manon Pittman about her career there, begun in her early teens, and the debut of Kentucky Unbound. You've been with the Callaway County Public Library for more than 20 years, and from what I've read, it doesn't seem like there's a lot around here that you haven't done in that time. Now that you're director, how is that informing the way you're doing your job today?
I think the background that I have here at the library is helping. The day-to-day process of the library is going really well. The financials and things like that I'm having to learn because I didn't do that before, but overall it's pretty well.
So far so good.
Yes, so far so good.
You started here when you were 14 years old, and I wonder if coming to work here was a matter of, hey, that sounds like a neat job, or was there an idea in your head that this is something you'd want to do?
Oh, no. sounds like a neat job. Mm-hmm. I wanted golf, had a program at Murray High, World of Work, and I was in that program. And so she would go out and find jobs for us, and we would work part-time. And Margaret Trevathan was one of her sponsors, so she streamed workers through here.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because as I've been reading through the news stories about your appointment, Margaret Trevathan is a name that keeps popping up and again and again. It certainly seems as though she was someone who was very influential, not only in your career, but in your life.
Yes, absolutely.
Could you tell us a little bit about her?
Margaret, very, in my opinion, wonderful woman. She, very work professional oriented, and trained her staff to be the same way. She loved the library and still does. And so she was a huge influence. Just her work ethics were so great, and she was all about getting the job done. Mm. And her focus was definitely the community, and that's what she instilled in all of her employees.
The new ebook lending program, Kentucky Unbound, is in the process of rolling out. Could you tell us a little bit about what Kentucky Unbound is?
It is a consortium, Kentucky Libraries, and the libraries, of course, pay a fee and you purchase together ebooks. There's some music and some video that you can also purchase. So with the consortium, we have in Kentucky Unbound access to all of their titles.
And it's across different kinds of platforms?
Yes.
For instance?
They have the different genres, romance and sci-fi and westerns. It's just a huge collection.
And you can get it on different devices?
Yes, you can get it on any e-reader, pretty much any e-reader.
Really?
Yes.
How long has that taken to come to fruition?
Since we've really pursued, because we talked about it, have been talking about it for about a year, but about 2 or 3 months. And today was our go live date, but we're having problems with our modem, so we're looking at June the 11th.
June the 11th?
Yes.
We'll see about that. Yes. Do you have any big plans for the future in the library?
We are working on improving and increasing our programming. Mm-hmm. We are in the process of working on forming a friends group for the library and partnerships with Murray State and Adam Murray and the library there.
Well, I've noticed that you've had a series of presentations on Fort Donelson. Is that going to be an ongoing partnership with National Park Service, other institutions like that?
Yes, that is our plan. He has some other programs, and as long as we have the space available, we will go forward with that. We are very excited about the direction that the library is going in now, and the staff is wonderful. Like I said before, the board, they're great. And so we are looking forward to just being a part of the community once again.
I spoke with Library Director Manon Pittman at her office at the Callaway County Public Library, and we have a link to information about their services and offerings at WKMS.org. If you want to take advantage of the new ebook lending service, Kentucky Unbound, you'll need to make sure you've got an e-reader, a good internet connection, and a valid card from your local library. Barring any technical issues, it's slated to arrive in Callaway County June 11th.
After the break, the unavoidability of counting and a look at the legendary feud between the Hatfields and McCoys, a part of Kentucky history that's drawn a lot of attention since the History Channel aired a three-part miniseries this past week. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
This is Front Page Sunday. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. If you've ever taken a math test or balanced a checkbook, you're likely aware that dealing with numbers and how they're put together can be a painful process. But as commentator Celia Brewer points out, whether we like it or not, the concept of counting is a fact of life.
Have you ever stopped to count just how often numbers pop up in our daily lives? First, there's the notion of time. We get up at 6:30, say, get to work at 8 or 9, break for lunch around 12. Kids get out of school at 3, businesses close at 5 or 6. Unless we're talking about fire departments, hospitals, and Walmart, they're open 24/7. Hospitals bring to mind all the medical numbers that follow us from the moment of birth, sometimes even earlier. As babies, we are weighed and measured. Our vital signs are taken, pulse, blood pressure, respiration. From then on, we play the numbers game for life. Schools are divided into grades. We score points on tests, with 100 usually the best. We accumulate a grade point average, important if we want to go to college. 4.0 is fabulous. But that's not the only criterion for college admission. On the ACT, anyone scoring in the 30s is pretty darn smart. They probably went to a school with a great student-teacher ratio or have an IQ of 132. Speaking of teachers, let's consider paychecks. Teachers are notoriously underpaid, given the number of years they must spend in college. In Kentucky, the starting teacher salary is roughly $30,600, with the average salary around $42,600. Professional athletes, however, are notoriously overpaid. After UK won its 8th national championship last month, the commentators were all talking one and done, the number of years a first-year Wildcat would stay in school before turning pro. After his amazing year, Anthony Davis is predicted to be the number one NBA draft pick this June, with the likelihood of seeing lots of zeros on his future paychecks. This 19-year-old is 6'10" in height, with the span of his arms about the same, I'd say. He blocked a record 186 shots in his first and apparently only season in the Big Blue Nation. Any mention of sports means statistics. Boys who can't remember formulas for high school algebra can often spout a host of stats regarding their favorite players and teams, whether it's Murray State's basketball record this year, 31-2 by the way, or the batting average of their favorite St. Louis Cardinal. The 138th Kentucky Derby, won this year by I'll Have Another, paid $32.60 on a $2 bet. Do you think we'll have a Triple Crown winner this year? Nowhere do numbers so dominate our lives than in our household budgets. Whether we earn a salary or make the minimum wage, $7.25 an hour, most of us have to align our income with our outgo for housing, utilities, groceries, and gas, currently averaging $3.60 a gallon in Kentucky. I don't know about you, but towards the end of the month, it is always a difficult balancing act in my checkbook to make sure the numbers in the credit column don't drop below those in the debit. A bounced check at my bank cost me $30. Undoubtedly, the number that concerns most of us is the number of our days. Now that I am 64, I pay closer attention to the obituary pages, not just to see if someone I know has died, but often I am mystified by the discrepancy in lifespans. Many Americans are now living into their 90s, but the local papers also report the deaths of teenagers or people in their 20s. Why is there such a wide range in this one inevitable fact of life? I try to remind myself often that it is not how long we live, but how well. Ultimately, it comes down not to numbers, but to punctuation. On most tombstones, there is a dash between the dates of birth and death. Our lives should be measured, indeed treasured, for how well we have lived between the two.
Celia Brewer is a writer living in Mayfield. Like the title of the new movie about mountain bikers, she believes there's strength in numbers. Her favorite numbers are 91.3.
Owensboro welcomes thousands of bluegrass and folk music enthusiasts later this month for the River of Music Party, or ROMP. Artists like Vince Gill, Old Crow Medicine Show, and the Carolina Chocolate Drops headline the three-day event. While it is entertaining, the event is also a bit educational for the budding artists who will attend. It includes workshops with professional musicians. Rose Kristen Presson spoke with the ROMP workshop coordinator, John Laswell, about how the workshops come together, what to expect, and some of this year's highlights.
Tell me a little about how these ROMP instrument workshops are going to work.
Usually every year it's kind of the same, different faces, same concept. You know, what instruments are being played. Based on those instruments, we're going to get the best players I can find. Back when I first started, I was always assuming that the workshops would be to help people learn how to play. And we sometimes get into that realm, but it's really, Pete Wernick and I talked, he said, John, it's not practical to have a bunch of musicians up there and a bunch of people there at all different levels and really do instruction. Yes, people can learn some things because they can see the players play up close and even ask a question, but it's not like a lesson like you would normally see where everybody gets in a certain point. Is everybody put your finger right here, place your hand like this. I think if you play an instrument and you can get to one of your workshops, I think you'll find it really entertaining, not because of anything I did, but because these guys, you know, really are great.
You've been doing the workshops for the International Bluegrass Music Association in Nashville for quite some time. How did you become the coordinator for IBMA and for ROMP for these instrument workshops. How did you get into this?
The first time I saw a workshop was the Kentucky Fried Chicken Festival, which was a major festival in Louisville. And I went up there, and it was like all the who's who of mandolin playing mandolins at one time. A guy named Buck White, Sam Bush, who's still one of the biggest names in the business, and they had David Grisman, had Roland White, and his brother Clarence. But anyway, it was just like, wow, look at all that. And I stopped and thought, well, that is neat. Why don't all the other festivals I go to have that? So I called Pete Wernick, said, I'm thinking about doing workshops, and I wonder if you could help me because I know you're the president of IBMA. And he gave me a lot of input as to, you know, well, this guy is more of a traditional player, and that's good, but now we need somebody a little bit more on the contemporary side. So, or, you know, he knew the personalities who might get along. There might be some conflict. Just all kinds of insights into the industry as to who does what and why. And I've done the IBMA workshops now for 23 years. They're moving to North Carolina next year, and that will be, this year will be my last with IBMA. And then I approached Gabrielle, and I saw that they had a little bit of things going on with workshops, and I said, can I do yours? It's my hometown, Owensboro, and I'd really like to do that. So it kind of turned out to be a nice way to continue doing that without, you know, driving far away.
What are some of the workshops that you're anticipating for this year at ROMP? Like, I'm especially looking forward to Sammy Sheeler, and I saw Scott Moore's last year, and his was great. I loved his workshop.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That particular one, again, would be a good one because Sammy Sheeler is, he won an award that Steve Martin, the actor comedian, presented to him and for Banjo Player of the Year, and he got a check for $50,000 from Steve Martin on Letterman. So Sammy is going to be back with his band, but there's another guy that's, to me, is really, he's been there before at the festival, but I've really grown to appreciate him. His name is Greg List. The typical way to play a banjo is you have a thumb and an index and a middle finger, and those three pick different notes at different times, and using roll patterns, they call them. Well, for whatever reason, Greg decided to have another finger added to the mix. I'm looking forward to his explanation as to why, because I'll be sure and ask that. But that's the only guy I've ever seen that does that. But anyway, he's in a group called the Deadly Gentlemen. And the Deadly Gentlemen, any workshop they're in, there's going to be another one I'm really going to be wanting to see.
Rose Kristen Presson spoke with ROMP workshop coordinator John Laswell. ROMP will be in Owensboro's Yellow Creek Park the last weekend of June. For a complete workshop schedule, visit WKMS.org and tune in next week for a talk with one of the artists.
I'm on a mission demanding, I'm on a mission demanding, living a dream, not a lie, living a misunderstanding. You may be kind, you may be the finest. I'll stay behind if you'll slay me, your highness. Slaughter me, baby, good or be bad. Whatever would ought to be, just good or be had. Slaughter me, please. Take my body, scatter it on the watery seas.
This past week, the History Channel aired a three-part miniseries on the deadly Hatfield-McCoy dispute that took place in eastern Kentucky, in Pike County, and across the Tug Fork of the Big Sandy River in West Virginia. The show boasted more than 14 million viewers. The University of Kentucky Press reports the original book on the Klans, written in 1982, is now among Amazon's and Barnes & Noble's best-selling e-books. So with the increased attention to this feud, we're joined by the vice chairman of the Pike County Tourism Commission, Reed Potter. Mr. Potter, I bet this isn't your first interview on the feud this week.
No, this is my fourth one today.
What are people wanting to know?
I think most interviews have either focused on what this is doing to tourism in our area or what we think is inaccurate about the story that was told in the miniseries this week.
Do you find it odd that Pike County's present claim to fame is that it's home to a deadly family feud?
You know, I've been involved in this for a long time, and first as a chairman of our tourism commission, and at that time, in the late 80s even, I brought up the idea of trying to promote the feud as a tourism resource, and even then there was resistance from the local people because they didn't want that image. And I think it's just taken that many years before people could get over that and say, you know, we can show them the truth. If they come here, they see the sights, they meet the people, they'll see the truth. And the worst thing we can do is ignore it because it's not going away. And if we ignore it, then the old stereotypes remain.
Do you think these stories, like the feud, play into Kentucky or Eastern Kentucky stereotypes?
I think if people come here, it will not. If all they see is an outsider's version of that, then that can be a problem. Just like the miniseries, that series is promoted and out of the governor's office of West Virginia. It's told from the West Virginia and the Hatfield point of view. And so even in that miniseries, although I thought they did a good job with it, they kind of make a lot of the McCoy supporters out to be fools and drunks, and that just wasn't true. So once again, by ignoring it in Kentucky, we let someone else tell the story, and they tell the story to make the Kentucky side look less than what it was. It was some very intelligent people who were of high character, and including Perry Klein, the attorney, who was the attorney for the Hatfields, by the way. That wasn't told correctly in the Feud miniseries. A very prominent man with many connections. He was a state legislator, and he was not nearly the scandal as they made him out to be in the miniseries. He tried to help resolve this and stop it as much as was in his power to do so.
So if this story is told from the West Virginia standpoint, are people in Pike County and far eastern Kentucky, are they upset with the portrayal of the film?
You know, on the second night I was watching, and I had Perry Klein's granddaughter call me. She's an older lady now, I've known for many decades, and she was upset, and she just asked me why they would do that to Perry Klein, who was such a great guy and accomplished a lot of things in his short life. He died at a young age. I think he was 42 when he died. I didn't have an answer for that, but really, other than her, I've not had any negative response at all. Everyone's really into the story, just like they are all over the country. And I know our sites here, the visitations are just through the roof, the phone calls coming in. We've had to bring in extra volunteers to help stuff envelopes to get information out so people could come and see what actually happened.
I'm sure you can't speak for family members, but have you heard of any of the Hatfields and McCoys in the area feeling exploited by the film?
No, I don't think so. I have talked to many of them. They live all around us here, both Hatfields and McCoys. There's some great friends of mine, a couple of doctors. There's many business people, CPA, that are great friends of mine. And I think the generation that felt that way is long gone. These people embrace it. They're kind of having fun with it. There's a reunion here of the Hatfield-McCoy families. It's more like a festival. They get together every June. There's a marathon where people from all over the world actually come, but it started out being part of that family reunion festival.
That would be a tough marathon in Pikeville.
Yeah, but it goes over a mountain. I have trouble driving over. I can't imagine running over it. But it's actually at the site of the feud. A lot of the killings, where Randolph McCoy's original cabin was, the graves, all those things, they run right by all those places. So it's really a cool marathon, and they've had over 400 runners in that. It just started, I think, about 8 years ago, and continued to grow until it got up to 400 runners. That's about all they can take. So they literally have people coming from other countries in here to run that marathon now.
In 25 or 50 years, would you prefer Pikeville to have another historical claim to fame other than the Hatfield and McCoy dispute?
Well, we feel like we do have several claims to fame, including the University of Pikeville and, of course, Governor Paul Patton, who's now the president of that university, and the energy capital of the world. So we feel like we have many other claims to fame besides the Hatfield-McCoy feud already. In fact, the Pikeville cut through. Big project was just named as one of the unique features of Kentucky by the Kentucky Tourism Council. So, and of course, we have the Brakes Interstate Park and our whitewater rafting and kayaking. So it's a beautiful scenic area that have attracted visitors for many decades without us doing anything to promote the Hatfield-McCoy feud. So it just happens to be that's the hot thing at the moment. And of course, we'll take advantage of it as we can.
Reed Potter, Vice Chairman of the Pike County Tourism Commission, thanks for your time.
All right.
The History Channel produced a factual documentary to clear up some of the exaggerated parts of the miniseries. You can see Reed Potter in that documentary, and you can find air times at the History Channel website. You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Casey Northcutt, Gary Pitts, and Rose Kristen Presson. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Markgraf provides website assistance.
If you have questions or comments about the stories you've heard today, you can email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. You can also have your say at our Facebook page, and there's a link to that page at our website, news.wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Thanks for being with us.